This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You're encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information and answers all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you on this Saturday morning, October 25th. And it gives me great pleasure to have as my guest today Dr. Mark Eisen. Dr. Eisen's an MD, PhD. He is an ear, nose, and throat surgeon and specializes in the field of neurotology. And this is that intersection of the ear and the brain. And specifically, he deals with patients who come in with complaints of dizziness, vertigo, things like you may have heard of, Meniere's disease, benign paroxysmal vertigo. Anyhow, he's going to be our guest at 11:20, so he'll be here in the second segment, and he will be here throughout the second half of the program. So if you have questions regarding dizziness, you can reach out to me live at info@alessimd.com. And we have a question from Terry. Actually, it was Terry who sent me an email several weeks ago who prompted me to have Dr. Eisen as our guest today. So looking forward to spending time with him. This day in medicine, October 25th, 1653, Dr. Theophraste Renaudot. He was a French physician, and that is when he was born. And this French physician was called the father of French journalism. Now, he published a lot of different things in his writing. He started a free medical clinic. He did some political journals, but the reason I wanted to remember him today is because it's been brought to my attention that the medical literature cannot always be trusted. Let me give you a concrete example. And that is, there are devices out on the market that are said to prevent concussion, cure concussion, reduce head injuries, protect the brain. And everybody wants to do that, especially for their children. There's one particular device that's become popular with professional athletes and high-level collegiate athletes. And a recent publication in the British Medical Journal was an investigative report. And it looked into the data and the articles presented, and specifically what this specific device told the FDA to get approval. And they did get approval. What was interesting was, again, suddenly when you have a product like this and there's a market for it, venture capital gets involved. And venture capital starts driving the bus, so to speak, in terms of being able to pay athletes to use their device and not necessarily basing it on science. Now, I'm not naming the device for a reason. And the reason is this particular group, the people around this device, if you say anything bad about their device, either in an interview, at a meeting, in public, and certainly in this venue, you get a letter saying to cease and desist and threatening you with a lawsuit. Now, any medical device that has to threaten a doctor with a lawsuit, if they say anything negative about it and substantiate that, boy, I'd be a little suspect of these folks. But that's the way they work. So the question becomes, the British Medical Journal went out and investigated this and actually found that in some of their supporting studies, They cut and pasted the data. The data were exactly the same in two studies. That doesn't happen. So there's a question of whether data was falsified. It brings us to another point. With the latest cuts here in the United States, okay, you remember Doge and these folks, what they've done is they've closed the federal agencies on ethics that impact scientific research. We've gotten rid of that. They didn't think we needed that. Yet, it appears that we need it more than ever. Those people got riffed out of jobs. And so we're at a situation where you have to trust your doctor and your situation and what it is. Now, I've had situations, especially with this particular device, where I had an athlete. He inquired. I gave him my advice regarding the question that there isn't real good support for using it. And then I saw him wearing it on the sideline. I found out that he got a check. So what they do is they pay athletes to wear it. I saw the athlete again this season, and he wasn't wearing the device. And basically, the check stopped. So you can't believe everything you see just because professional athletes and other people are using the device. And it's hard to believe what they're writing and what they're saying. So let me be as focused as I can tell you, and that is, please listen to your doctor, because they're the ones who will have your best interest at heart. And looking at this, we need to really watch and look at these particular devices because people are being taken advantage of, and it's not inexpensive. The other thing we're dealing with, as everyone knows in the news, is that the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program will come to an end on November 1st. So these SNAP benefits that are made available to people who are in a low-income or disabled category are provided by the federal government. We used to call them food stamps, right, in the old days. But so these supplemental nutrition program and these benefits affect over 350,000 people just in the state of Connecticut. Now, the reason we don't have it is because the government's closed. We're now at 25 days into having essentially no working government, no working Congress. People are being laid off, and you see it. I never thought I'd live to this, to see this, where federal workers are in line at food kitchens, right? And that's what we've come to. So as of November 1st, the way it stands, these supplemental nutrition assistance programs will be subsided. And as we know, food is essential. Matter of fact, in California, they've sent the National Guard out to distribute food. Again, this is almost unbelievable. So this isn't just people on SNAP needing these benefits. We have people who are government employees thinking they have some great job security who are lined up to try and get food to feed their families. I keep thinking we've reached a new low, but I think we keep getting lower. Now, there is talk that the state of Connecticut may be able to use surplus funds to provide the money so these folks get the SNAP benefits. But that's going to cost us $72 million a month. And we do pay taxes to a federal government that's closed and isn't distributing food to people who are in need. So we need to really keep mindful of this, and we need to let elected officials, I don't care what party they're in, you need to let them know that this is wrong. And someone needs to take action on this. Another article came up. We were at Grand Rounds a couple of weeks ago, and a study was presented again, and this one was a study where they looked at 500,000 participants in the UK and the United States. And these folks are all aged 56 to 72. 15,000 cases in this 500,000 group were recognized as having dementia. But specifically, what they were looking at was the use of alcohol and how it impacts our lives. Now, we've all heard the theories that, you know, a glass of red wine every day, you'll live longer, or two glasses will help you. And everybody has an anecdotal story. You know, my aunt drank, whiskey every day, and she lived to 100, okay? And so there's been this argument, probably purported by a lot of the liquor manufacturers, but that by drinking alcohol to a mild or modest degree, you can live longer. So this study looked at that. And what they found that was increasing levels of alcohol consumption were associated with higher rates of the following: heart disease, stroke, hypertension, atrial fibrillation, dementia, cerebrovascular disease, and heart failure. So in looking at a large scale, not just dementia, when they wanted to go out and just look at dementia, but they found all these other things. Also, what they found was when using alcohol, people who drank alcohol regularly were also more susceptible to increases in rates of accidents, right? Motor vehicle accidents, motorcycle accidents, falling off a bike, trauma, right? We've all seen this, right? People who are drinking can fall down a flight of stairs, get into a fight. They also found increases in several rates of cancer, liver disease, and here's the winner, a shorter lifespan. When you compared these folks in this same group of 500 to those who did not drink alcohol, those who drank alcohol had a shorter lifespan. When we looked at the amount of alcohol, they found that no level of alcohol consumption was found to be safe or beneficial. That's a lot. It's a lot to unpack. And for many people who are listening to this, I mean, it's, you may be older and used to doing it, but I think the issue now is, as a physician, much like I have to tell somebody, you know, stop smoking. And that's had a benefit, let's face it. There are fewer smokers out there. But we deal with young people, and those are the people who this is going to affect the most. And we all see the slicker commercials for wine coolers, or they try to play it down in terms of alcohol lemonade or whatever it is. But as a physician now, I think that we have to not only address smoking, but we've got to address alcohol and give proper advice to our patients. And I think as far as our children and grandchildren go, again, play down these marketing efforts to get everybody to drink more alcohol. With that, we're going to take a short break. Then we're going to be back with my guest today, Dr. Mark Eisen. If you wish to reach out to me with questions, you could reach out at info@alessimd.com. I have several questions that have come in, so we will get those to Dr. Eisen. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it gives me great pleasure to introduce my guest today, Dr. Mark Eisen. Dr. Eisen is an MD, PhD, ear, nose, and throat specialist. He is the principal at Ear Specialty Group of Connecticut on 40 Stamford Drive in Farmington, Connecticut. And he is the go-to person when it comes to dizziness here in Connecticut. He's treated my own family, and I refer patients to him frequently because of his expertise in making patients get better. Mark, welcome to the show.
Tony, thanks for having me. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, good.
Let's talk a little bit. Can you explain to our listeners what neuro-otology is?
Yeah, good question, because, well, my mother has no idea what I do. So it's a subspecialty. So I'll give you the short answer and then the long answer. So the short answer is neuro-otology is E of ENT. So it's just the ear part of ENT. So that's the short answer. But there's a more significant long answer, which is about 300 years old is the specialty of otolaryngology. That's ear, nose, and throat. It's problems with the ears, the middle ear, the outer ear, throat, nose, a lot of things that have really been understood as common problems in humans for hundreds of years. But what happened about 100 years ago is we started to learn more about the inner ear and how it worked. The inner ear has two functions. It has a hearing function and a balance function. And the whole inner ear is about the size of a dime. And it's housed in the temporal bone, which is on the side of your skull and the skull base, where it's probably the most complex anatomy in the body. In a very small space, there's some very important structures. So not only was it hard to understand how the inner ear worked, but to have access to do anything to it was so challenging because it's encased in bone. It's surrounded by some important structures, including the brain. And starting about 100 years ago, advances were made both in understanding the inner ear function and then anatomically being able to manipulate it. So then what happened is the field developed that was able to work on the skull base, take tumors out that grow around the inner ear and the brain, and to start thinking about how the inner ear worked, which then led to significant advances in the cochlear implant, which was developed in the 1970s. So what inevitably happens with these subspecializations in medicine is it's really hard to get good at something when it's so complex without focusing on it. And then the subspecialty of neuro-otology developed from ear, nose, and throat so that more training was available and experts in the field, and we would get together such that now neuro-otology really means working on the inner ear and being able to go on both sides of the covering of the brain called the dura. So now neuro-otology is much more specialized than just ear, nose, and throat. And that kind of leads me to what do I do? So I have this specialized training, but my practice really is limited to a couple things. One is it's surgery on the middle ear. So that I do that. Those are things like ear infections and something called cholesteatoma and stapedectomy. Those are middle ear problems that I work on. There's skull-based surgery, which is taking out tumors like acoustic neuromas and working with the neurosurgeon. There's implantable hearing devices like a cochlear implant. And then the last thing, which I think you wanted to talk about most, which was management and diagnosis of the dizzy patient. So that is my practice. So I limit it to just that, and I don't do any noses and throats anymore. That's the long answer.
Well, that was a very complete answer, to say the least. What percentage of your practice are people with dizziness? I mean, we just hear it all the time.
Well, there's two ways you can be a neuro-otologist in practice. One is to, because there's not enough tumor work and cochlear implant work to keep one practitioner busy 100% of the time. So you can either see general ear, nose, and throat and also do some ear tubes, tonsils, you know, things sure. that are like noses and throats. There's general ear, nose, and throat to supplement to your time. I chose to not do that. I chose the other path, which is to see dizzy patients. Dizziness is like the third most common reason why patients seek medical attention.
Sure.
So the number of dizzy patients is essentially unlimited. And most other physicians and other specialties, they don't like treating dizziness. It's hard for good reason. And what I had developed since being here for 20 years is realizing there's so many dizzy patients and my training is so thorough that it's now about at least 80% of the practice.
Wow. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to be back with Dr. Eisen. We're going to get into dizziness. What is dizziness? How does it differ from vertigo? Are there age-related problems? And really, what do we do? How do you work it up? How do we treat dizziness? If you have questions for me, you could reach out at info@alessimd.com. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to have as my guest today, Dr. Mark Eisen. Dr. Eisen is an ear, nose, and throat surgeon and specialist in neurotology. If you wish to reach out to Dr. Eisen at his office, the phone number is 860-640-4455. Mark, when we ended at the end of the segment, we started talking about dizziness. Can you talk a little bit more about dizziness, vertigo, and how these terms all work?
Yeah, so the probably the most important thing to start the conversation is to know that dizziness means different things to different people. And if you put 100 people in a room and ask, what's dizziness mean to you? You'll get many different answers that tend to fall into four camps. The first is lightheadedness, which is like a head rush. You stand up real fast, the blood rushes from your head. The extreme version of lightheaded is you pass out, but that person will say, I feel dizzy. The next is spinning vertigo. Like literally the definition of that is the room is wildly spinning around and you're not moving it. So it's that sensation of wild spinning when you're not moving. The third camp is going to be disbalance, which is being clumsy, essentially having trouble walking. You have trouble putting one foot in front of the other, and you may fail a sobriety test. And then I think the fourth category I'm going to call disequilibrium, which is the sensation that you may be rocking or moving a little, but you're not spinning, you're not lightheaded. And if you take those four camps, the reason you need to break down dizziness into those four is the diagnoses and the treatment for the different entities are totally different. So things like surgery and medicine and physical therapy, it totally matters what the diagnosis is. And the key to understanding, diagnosing, and managing dizziness is to get to the root cause and then find the treatment that goes along with that root cause.
So when you think of it, when people come into your office, let's say, what can they expect as far as a workup or you know, basic tests that you would want to see in someone who comes in with dizziness? And I granted it's going to be different in all four categories, but what's most typical?
Yeah, so we actually have tried to make – so the Dizzy Clinic is what I developed starting when I came in 2007 to Connecticut. And the idea is – for anyone with a primary complaint of dizziness to come in and get an organized set of tests and a consultation and come out with a diagnosis and a treatment plan. So given that there are so many forms of dizziness and causes, we have decided to make it consistent so that everyone just tells us they're dizzy. Once you're dizzy, you come in. We run four tests that are looking at inner ear balance function and inner ear hearing function. Those are key to, because those are very objective measurements of how the inner ear is working. And then the other really important part of this is just to hear people's stories, because you'll see as people start discussing their dizziness, that feeds into their diagnosis based on what they say the character of the dizziness is, the timing of the dizziness, and all that information kind of gets put together. And then in the end, we're able to make diagnoses. Now, diagnoses are so wide and varied from we just need to reassure people to we need to operate on people. And then the whole range in between, the list of diagnoses is extensive, but it's probably 10 very common things and then maybe a bunch of very uncommon things. And that's it. So I make it sound simple, but the reason we have simplified it is because we have experience over the last 15 years of doing it.
It's not simple. I mean, by any means. And I could tell you, when you originally said it's things most physicians don't want to deal with. I mean,
right.
Once you hear dizzy, you're getting a headache yourself. But and it's an, it, it's
I
it's
think not, the reason for I think one of the reasons for that is much of understanding dizziness is having people describe their symptoms rather than a test result that shows something. Like low potassium is very well defined because it's on a blood test. The problem with dizziness is many times people present to their physician without having the symptom. So you can't see it. You have to have the patient describe it. And because the variety of causes is so different and the treatment so different, I think that's one of the reasons that the physicians in other specialties just get frustrated.
Would you say benign paroxysmal positional vertigo, BPPV, is the most common thing you see or the most common form of dizziness?
No, but it's very common. So the most common cause of spinning vertigo, which again is feels like the room is spinning around and around, the most common cause of that is BPPV, benign paroxysmal positional vertigo. And we're going to have to stop saying all the words. There's too many.
Yeah,
so we'll call it BPPV. But the physiology is very interesting. The name is not that important. The physiology is little crystals in the inner ear that everyone has. All humans have them. They're very useful. They're for sensing, like when you're in a car or gravity. And what happens, and we don't understand why, but it's very common, these little crystals find themselves, it's like they float into the wrong place in the inner ear, which is right next to where they're supposed to be. Now what happens is nothing until you shake the crystals around in the wrong place. And that happens when you put your head in different positions with respect to gravity, meaning lying, turning over in bed, looking up, and those kind of position changes. And then with those position changes, you're artificially stimulating the part of the inner ear that shouldn't have any crystals. And that tells your brain that your head is being thrown around and you feel the sensation of spinning vertigo that lasts for seconds. But that can keep repeating itself, and you can feel it's kind of yucky in between. So it's episodic positional vertigo. And, yeah, that's the most common reason why vertigo happens. And then there's other causes, too. But the nice thing about that entity is we will see it. There's some very good tests that we do to see if you have the crystals in the wrong place. And the best news around is that if they're in the wrong place, we can put them back. And the physical therapists do this. They just maneuver them back. And it's extremely effective therapy that does not require medicine and doesn't require surgery. But the key is you have to have that problem. Because if you don't have that problem, you do the treatment, nothing's going to happen.
And the Epley maneuver has become so common now. I mean, that it almost seems like people just treat it all the time or actually have begun treating it themselves.
So there's job security for the physical therapist here because it's super easy. Well, there's six canals, three in each side, that can have the crystals in the wrong place. So you need six maneuvers, and you need to know which canal it is. Well, that's already the setup for something that's hard. And then the maneuvers themselves are really easy to do wrong. So not only is it easy to pick the wrong maneuver, but it's easy to do the maneuvers wrong. So the physical therapists that are well-trained to do this, I think are really required to do it right. And you can YouTube an Epley maneuver, but then you need to know if it's a right Epley maneuver or a left Epley maneuver. And that's only for the posterior canal. You see, it gets complex fast. The Epley maneuver is named after John Epley. He passed away a couple of years ago. He was an ear, nose, and throat doctor on the West Coast. And he was trained as an ear surgeon. And he realized he was like thinking about the problem and thinking about the anatomy. And he like on the back of a napkin one day, he's like, all you have to do is, and that's when he developed some maneuvers to maneuver the particles back. And it's extremely effective therapy.
Some great sciences come on the back of napkins. Have you noticed?
That's why I like that story.
That's a great story. I have a question from Terry who brought this up. And there doesn't seem anything that relieves my dizziness, including the Epley maneuvers. I did get referred to the dizzy clinic in Farmington, so she maybe your patient are coming up. But when that fails, what do you go to?
Yeah, so we have to back up because you see, you have to have the correct diagnosis of why you're dizzy before you get a treatment plan, and only some of those benign positional vertigo. So if you have, you need the diagnosis first. And only benign positional vertigo will be treated effectively with maneuvers. So you, in that, now we're into the list of all the other things that can cause dizziness. And that's why it's useful to start the whole process of asking. So this is what happens when you come to the dizzy clinic.
So let's move on to something that's fairly common, I think, Meniere's disease.
Yeah, not common at all. So Meniere's disease is really uncommon. It's overdiagnosed.
Okay, let me qualify that. It's commonly diagnosed, but probably rarely seen.
It's commonly diagnosed, but right, it's very overdiagnosed. So this is an uncommon inner ear problem. And what happens with one inner ear at a time? So you have to lateralize all symptoms to one side, meaning left or right. And for some reason, the pressure within the inner ear, which includes the hearing part and the balance part of the inner ear, because of an inflammatory response, the pressure increases, usually over hours, and then dissipates. And the increase in the pressure in the inner ear results in hearing loss, ear fullness, and ringing in one ear that kind of crescendos. And then as it dissipates, there's an intense vertigo lasting for minutes or hours. And these events or these attacks come on without really having a known trigger. Not an ideal disease to have because of the unpredictability of it. But the good news is it's treatable.
When you go about treating it, now there have been a lot of different things, salt in the diet being related to it, a lot of different things, or benzodiazepines. How do you approach somebody with that?
Yeah, so once you have a solid diagnosis of Meniere's disease, that implies that you know which ear it is. And the treatments for Meniere's disease that work are all ear-specific. So, and you mentioned some of the things that have been done in the past. That it's funny because some standard of care treatment for Meniere's disease includes a low-salt diet and a diuretic, and no one's ever shown those to be effective in any kind of systematic study. So, and this is the way medicine works, which is, we don't know why that helps some people, but it doesn't help everybody. So once you know which ear it is, the treatments are all ear-specific. And it starts with steroid injections in the ear. And what that does is it's very effective at reducing the attack frequency. The reason people are disabled by Meniere's disease is because the attacks, not only did it takes them out of commission for a day, but it's not predictable. If it was, you know, if Meniere's disease would say, okay, every fourth Tuesday, you're going to have to take the day off of work, well, that would be much more tolerable, but it's pretty random.
Yeah.
So the steroid injections are super effective. And then there's other ways to, ear-specific ways to manage the inner ear. But that's the steroid injections is the simplest and actually works for most people.
Can we move on to talk about probably the best name drug ever, Antiverge. Okay.
However, isn't that a great name? It's so easy to remember. Antiverge.
Right. Yeah. Right. Somebody, some genius, right, down on Madison Avenue came up with Antiverge. And, I mean, so many people get first thing, as soon as they go to an emergency room, walk-in clinic,
every time.
I'm dizzy. Every time, here's some Antiverge.
I'm happy to talk about Antiverge.
Please.
And I'm a little worried that at some point the Antiverge people are going to come knocking on my door, and you'll hear why that is. So Meclizine, which is Antiverge, that's the generic name. Meclizine is a nausea pill for seasickness, and it's super duper safe and it's cheap. So that's a good setup for everyone to get it. But it's only giving you it's like a mild to moderate anti-nausea medication. It doesn't make you less dizzy. It makes you sleepy. So now you're sleeping and you're less nauseous. So notice the problem, which is people get it for dizziness. They get it for disbalance. It's just going to make you tired and off balance. It's almost never indicated, except if you're on a boat and you're nauseous. Most people who go to the emergency room are not really that nauseous. They're dizzy. And it's not helping. So the irony is that although Meclizine is given out like water, it's given out because if you don't know the diagnosis, and then why don't you just give someone some antivirus, because it's easy to remember. Not great medicine, and it's super safe. That's the good news, but it really is not helping a lot of people.
I have a question from John here, and it concerns something I think we see, and that is people who enjoy going on amusement rides. And is it possible that after going on an amusement ride, you will remain dizzy and vertiginous? And I've seen that, I guess. I struggle every time I'm at a baseball game and I see the dizzy bat contest, okay? Because it's just so anti-everything we do, all right? Especially when it's an older person, right? They pick the oldest person there who's going to probably fall and break a hip. But can you talk a little bit about amusement rides and how that affects the inner ear?
Yeah, let me – I don't want to get – I'm not going to name my fraternity, but I'm going to talk about one of the fraternity's hazing activities was to have a bat, and you had to put your head on the bat and spin around and around and then drink some kind of a soda.
Oh.
Anyway, that was a long time.
Even worse.
That was,
okay.
That was awful. Yeah. There's an entity that after you've been on an activity that involves motion, and it's just typically described as a boat. So after you get off a boat, for some reason, the way the brain is dealing with what you see and what you sense with your ears, so it crosses the wires in the brain, and it results in the sensation. It's not vertigo. It's a sense of disequilibrium. So you feel off balance and maybe swaying. And there's an entity called mal de débarquement. It's a French term. It means you still feel like you're on the boat after you get off the boat. And it's not uncommon. What's uncommon is something that's unfortunate, which is mal de débarquement syndrome, which means you've been off the boat for months and you still feel that you're on the boat in disequilibrium. And it's not common, but it's out there. And so the answer is yes, this can happen. It doesn't mean it happens every time. And if you're someone who really has intense motion sensitivity, there's ways of desensitizing to motion sensitivity, and the physical therapist can do that.
How would you treat someone with that syndrome? Would it be physical therapy?
It depends on if it's someone who's actively feeling off balance or someone who comes in who typically gets the sensation but isn't in it. You know, someone who says, every time I go on a car ride, I get nauseous and it lasts for minutes or hours, as opposed to someone who comes in who's been months being uncomfortable. So those are two different ways to treat it. Generally, the physical therapist can help. When the physical therapists are able to do vestibular therapy, which stimulates the inner ear and the balance mechanism and can like push the reset button. So sometimes physical therapy will help with the patients who are still symptomatic. But what you can do for the people who tend to have this problem over and over again is they can get desensitization training. And that's a way to teach your brain not to get upset when you go on the boat, essentially.
Well, do you ever have to do surgery for people? Is it only if you have a structural abnormality, or is there a surgical approach to dizziness in general?
Yeah, so I operate on about one out of 1,000 patients who comes in with dizziness. And there's a couple reasons you would want to operate. One is benign positional vertigo that just won't go away with maneuvers. Or someone who has benign positional vertigo that happens so often and for so long that even if the maneuvers are working, they spend most of their life with episodic positional vertigo. And if you can identify the canal surgically, I can go plug the canal. So that's one surgery I do. There's an entity that is rare but right up my alley called superior semicircular canal dehiscence, and long name, and it means that part of the surrounding bone of the inner ear is open with respect to the brain. And then you can get some strange symptoms, including dizziness and hearing your own voice, and that's another surgical problem. And other than that, in Meniere's disease, there's a few surgeries that we don't have to do very often because the medical management is so effective. But so those are the entities that I do operate on. And those are very subspecialized surgeries.
Yeah, you know, at the end of every show, I always ask somebody, what's there something new in their field? And when I posed that question to you before the show, you mentioned a topic I didn't actually think about that's very common, and that is tinnitus, which is a very annoying and disabling. I think many people have probably had it, and it just kind of goes away, but sometimes it doesn't. So in the last few minutes of the show, can you talk a little bit about tinnitus and what can be done about it?
I'm going to briefly talk about tinnitus in general, because most tinnitus, which is super common in humans, there's no treatment. And it can be frustrating, but it tends not to be a medical problem. It tends to be an annoyance. But the workup for tinnitus, it's important to get a hearing test. And it's important to have an ear, nose, and throat doctor at least work it up and give a look, get a hearing test, and then any other tests that are required. But most of the time, regular tinnitus, hissing, there's tones, some people hear music, but there's a subset. Nothing can be done about those. But there's one subset of tinnitus, which is called pulsatile tinnitus. And that's you hearing your own pulse in one ear. And what you're hearing is turbulent blood flow in one ear. And that problem has a list of anatomic reasons why, and we can find this with, we can find this anatomically, that there's an abnormal, it's like an abnormal loudspeaker in the temporal bone, such that you're hearing your pulse when you shouldn't be hearing it. And usually what happens is there's places in the temporal bone that are missing bone, and that bone can be put back. And when that's found, pulsatile tinnitus in one ear can be treated effectively.
You know, it's such a problem for many people, and it has so many psychiatric effects as well.
Yeah.
So I'm glad we got to chat about that. Mark, thank you. Thank you for your time today and sharing your knowledge. But more importantly, thanks for all the good things you do for patients in our community.
That's really
your
great.
Work is so important to so many people, and so many of my patients and family members have really enjoyed working with you and having you as their doctor. Thank you.
Yeah, my pleasure. You bet.
We're going to take a short break. Then we're going to be back to wrap things up. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. Many thanks to my guest, Dr. Mark Eisen, who has spent time with us today. If you wish to reach out to Dr. Eisen, the phone number is 860-640-4455. Many thanks to our studio producer, Kevin Korsh, who's been on the board. Jeff Chandler's in charge of sales and marketing for Healthy Rounds. Next week, we are going to have, I'm going to do a live introduction, but we're going to use a taped interview that we did recently, since I will be covering UConn football. If you missed any part of today's program, you could get it back at the Healthy Rounds podcast, and you could download that at Odyssey.com or Apple Podcasts. Next up on WTIC is going to be attorney John Matulis with Law Talk. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and UConn Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com. Till then, stay well.